Welcome to another edition of the Law of Code podcast.
Anything mentioned in this episode by Jacob Robinson or his guests is not legal advice or investment advice. All opinions are Jacob's and his guests alone. Nothing discussed today should be relied upon for legal or investment decisions. This show is solely for information and entertainment purposes only. Jacob and his guests are not your lawyers, nor are they investment advisors. Please work directly with a lawyer or investment professional.
All right, I want to start by rewinding to the spring of 2021. Roman Sterlingov, a 33-year-old Swedish-Russian national, was arrested by the IRS criminal investigators at the Los Angeles airport. He was accused of creating and operating Bitcoin Fog, a mixing service that the U.S. Justice Department claims Sterlingov used to enable 336 million in money laundering over Bitcoin Fog's decade online. The government charged Sterlingov by criminal complaint with money laundering, operating an unlicensed money transmitting business, and money transmission without a license. Which is interesting, because unlike the Roman Storm Tornado Cash case, there was no IEPA charge here. That was a podcast we did earlier this week. Sterlingov denied the charges, and prosecutors in his case haven't found any smoking gun digital evidence retrieved from his possessions or devices when he was arrested. Instead, the statement of facts released when charges against Sterlingov became public detailed a combination of blockchain-based crypto tracing, IP address matching, and online account information links. The IRS says that was sufficient, and a jury agreed. Today's podcast covers this in depth, and I'm joined by J.W. Verrett, an associate professor at George Mason and an expert witness who testified in this case, as well as Roman's defense counsel, Tor Eklund, a trial and appellate lawyer best known for representing hackers and white-collar defendants, as well as his associate, Michael Hassard, an associate at Tor Eklund Law, and a fellow Canadian, which is always a good thing. So guys, thank you for joining me. Let's start with Bitcoin Fog. Can you explain the history of this Bitcoin mixing service and why it was of interest to the US DOJ?
Yes, Bitcoin Fog is one of the early Bitcoin mixers that starts in 2011. It wasn't the only one back then. 2011 is a heady year for Bitcoin. It seems like looking back now, like it's like the first year where all this stuff really starts to happen. Duncan Townsend had started up a mixer called Blind Bitcoin, and the government brought him in on the case and whatnot. But essentially in 2011, Bitcoin Fog starts operating in October. And for those of you who don't know what a mixer just basically, it breaks the tracing chain in the flow of funds. So most people use them for privacy reasons, because as I've discovered on this case, if somebody just knows your wallet address and they've got some way to link it to you, say you do a transaction with them or whatever, because that your personal information isn't on the blockchain, then they can trace back and see how many Bitcoin you have, and that can lead to you basically getting mugged, right? For a lot of people, for a lot of reasons, people use mixers for privacy reasons. And what the government didn't like about Bitcoin Fog is that they claim that it, you know, laundered all sorts of drug money from Silk Road and Agora and all these sites. And like you said, they accused Roman of operating it for 10 years. But when they arrested him at LAX, and in terms of evidence at trial, nothing ever came out. There's no direct evidence of Roman ever operating Bitcoin Fog. This entire case is built on circumstantial evidence, which anybody knows trial, a jury can give as much weight to circumstantial evidence as direct evidence. But what's striking about this case is there's not a single piece of direct evidence showing Roman ever operating Bitcoin Fog, yet the jury still basically convicted on essentially what were just traces. And I think if you're familiar with the CSI effect, I think there was a lot of CSI effect in retrospect in this case.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in detail. I want to just take a step back and talk about Roman for a second. So why would he have been the subject of an investigation?
Roman got into Bitcoin in 2010, back when it was priced at roughly 30 cents per Bitcoin. He got in originally by buying it in cash from somebody who had mined it. He bought it for a substantial amount at that time, maybe about 2,000, 3,000 euros worth, which was a lot of Bitcoin. He would then go around to bars, Bitcoin meetups, conferences, and he was selling Bitcoin to people, encouraging them to adopt Bitcoin, develop a wallet, get into it. And so when he went around, he was selling Bitcoin for cash. And this is when people told him that, hey, you know what? You should be using a mixer. This is around the same time that Bitcoin Fog is being developed and these other mixers are coming out in 2011. And what appears to have happened was that somebody bought Bitcoin from Roman and then went ahead and set up Bitcoin Fog. When the government used their tracing methods, Roman was the only person who had KYC'd his account, and he was at the beginning of the transaction line, right? It looks like the government's adopted a perspective of downward liability on this stuff, which is very scary to anybody who deals with Bitcoin or any kind of cryptocurrency. But what really happened is it appears that Roman was selling Bitcoin to people at these conferences, and a bad actor bought Bitcoin from him, knowing that anybody who's looking into their illicit activities would be able to trace it back to Roman and not themselves. And everybody seems to have fallen for it.
Yeah, like when you look at the traces here, one of the things that's striking is that Roman's accounts are the only ones that are KYC'd. Like the main trace in this case is this 2011 trace where they traced the flow of funds from his Mt. Gox account at the time, which was KYC'd, through a couple of addresses, then through a couple other Mt. Gox accounts, and then through a ARM exchange account to a Liberty Reserve account, which then pays for the DNS registration for the BitcoinFog.com ClearNet site, the regular internet, www.BitcoinFog.com ClearNet site, which had a link to the Onion site because the mixer was on the Onion site. But you have to make all these assumptions and attributions in every step in this trace, and they don't have any solid evidence to make those attributions. You have to make this sort of speculative leap. And what one of the things that I think is I get from this case, and anybody litigating these kinds of cases needs to worry about, is that there's a very, I think, powerful psychological tendency of people to attribute the flow of funds to the same thing as the flow of control of funds, even though they're two separate things. And time and again in this case, you see these traces, the only person KYC'd in these long transactions with multiple inputs and all this stuff like that is Roman, right? So he's like the low-hanging fruit. And it does look like to me what Mike was saying, that I think at some point he interacted with the people who started Bitcoin Fog, or maybe was hanging out with them or whatever. But that should scare the fuck out of everybody, because you don't know the backgrounds of everybody you're hanging out with. You don't know the backgrounds of the people you're transacting with. And for that to be the basis of liability for decades in jail is really fucking scary, right? Like,
yeah, whatever. Yeah. No, it's a really good point. You don't know what's going on off chain. And that's a big, that's a massive component of all these transactions. If I take crypto from a Coinbase account and I send it to a wallet, and then that wallet sends it to somewhere else, nobody knows whether that's a transaction from me to myself in another wallet or me to somebody else. And there can be really interesting and really dangerous things that can happen after that. But I want to just rewind and see how you, Tor, and Mike both got involved in this case. What's the story there?
So I have a really good friend who lived in Boston. He recently passed away, unfortunately. But one of his good friends from Boston happens to be Roman's cousin. So when Roman got arrested at Los Angeles International Airport, the first person he reached out to was his cousin who lived in the United States. He explains the issue. This is a little while after he gets arrested too. And his cousin reaches out to my friend, and my friend reaches out to me because he knows that I'm connected with Tor and practice federal criminal law in the computer space. And from then on, it was, we're defending Roman full blast. It sat on our desk for a little bit. We didn't realize the significance of this case for a few weeks. But then we went down to visit Roman and hear his story. We went to visit him at the Rappahannock region, or what is it? The Northern Neck Regional Jail in Rappahannock, Virginia.
Northern Neck,
yeah. Virginia. And when we get there, we talk to him. We're asking him about what happened, what he got accused of. And within 5 minutes, we realize, holy fuck, you're totally innocent. And we've been defending him full steam ahead since then. And my ears are still ringing from the verdict of last month, guilty on 4 counts, knowing that he's innocent. And there's a big problem here. So we're facing the appeal now. We're getting ready for that. And we're going to keep doing what we can to get this guy out of prison.
Yeah, let's talk about those 4 counts for a second and the impact a decision like that has on someone like Roman. Could you remind people what those 4 counts are and what's at stake for Roman personally here?
Decades in jail. The first count was conspiracy to money launder. your standard conspiracy count. But with the conspiracy to money laundering, you don't, for those of you who know conspiracy law, you don't have to prove an overt act in furtherance. So that's in derogation of the common law of conspiracy, and which is already, I think, terrible. They call conspiracy the prosecutor's friend. And in this case, there was no direct evidence of any communications between any co-conspirators. And again, if the rules of evidence, there's this exception to the hearsay rule for co-conspirator statements. And the government basically just named the entire dark net as co-conspirators. And on that basis, just got in a whole slew of statements, just all sorts of crap from Silk Road and stuff that I think under federal evidence 403, which is more prejudicial than probative, it shouldn't come in, shouldn't have come in on a conditional basis before it was even established that there was any conspiracy. And this is another, I'm a little bit of a sidebar here, but it shocked me about this court. They were like, we're letting all this in conditionally, and later we'll rule whether or not these people are actually co-conspirators. I'm like, you can't unring that bell with the jury. And the judge just basically said, the federal courts wouldn't be able to function if you couldn't let in evidence on a conditional basis, to which I'm thinking, are they really functioning if they need to let in all this evidence conditionally? That sounds really dysfunctional to me in a federal criminal trial. So anyhow, first count, that's a conspiracy to money launder. The second count is your straight up money laundering count, which JW is the expert professor on that stuff, and tell you all sorts of problems with the money laundering counts in this case. And then the third one is what operating an unregistered money transmission business that should have been registered with FinCEN. And then the fourth one, which I just like blows my mind, is not basically operating an unlicensed money transmission business in the District of Columbia, which Roman had never set foot in. They're all felony charges, and we haven't seen the sentencing guidelines calculation yet, but he's looking at decades potentially.
Let's talk about that venue decision for a second. Like, he had never set foot in the District of Columbia. Why was the case brought there?
Got the right guy. Torres, the venue lawyer.
Yeah, I always bust my balls, but that was my first big case. We went on venue. Just for those who you out there who may not be familiar, like, the United States Constitution requires that all federal criminal trials occur in the state and the district where the crime occurred. It's one of actually the few rights, or maybe the only one, that's like in two places in the United States Constitution. It's in Article 3 in the main body, the one that they passed and wrote in 1787, and it's in the Sixth Amendment. And the reason for that is the Crown was taking revolutionaries from Philadelphia and giving them a jury trial in London. It's a very different jury. Now, why are we in D.C. when there's no evidence of anything happening in D.C. except for one thing? And this is the only reason that we are in D.C. The IRS criminal investigators they mixed some Bitcoin through Bitcoin Fog while they were in D.C. Before they did it, they sent a message to whatever the Bitcoin Fog help desk, right? That was like, hi, we'd like to launder some drug money. Is your site a good site for laundering drug money? No response. They mixed their Bitcoin, put it back in a wallet that's allegedly in D.C. That's it. Now, the problem with that for me as a computer lawyer is that is universal jurisdiction for any prosecutor logging onto the internet using a website. That cannot be if that's true for computer cases, we have now erased, in my opinion, the venue clause. And I think the judge saw the problem here, because we filed a motion to dismiss on this issue about a year and a half, 2 years before trial. He never issued a written decision on it. I've never had that happen in a decade of doing federal criminal law. And we even had to ask in a motion in limine for him to rule on the issue, because I think it's a huge issue. And like Mike was saying, our first big case, the one that made us like known, is a venue case in a computer context where they say, no, venue wasn't proper. He just dodged the issue and ruled from the bench and just said, you're wrong. But didn't have the fucking balls to face up to it, because I think he was too scared to actually issue a written decision where what he said would get looked at closely by the appellate court. And I think that kind of cowardice reflects poorly on the federal courts in a situation like this, where somebody is facing decades in jail. And I was really just disappointed in the court on that front.
Just on that point, for those unfamiliar with the U.S. system, here. Is there a basis for any appeal on a point like that where the judge didn't
yes,
have
absolutely.
A decision on it? Yeah.
Yeah, huge. It's a huge appellate issue. And I think that's why he was afraid to issue a written decision, because judges don't like to get reversed on appeal. So he didn't want to get caught up in the minutia. But yeah, no, that's the whole reason. Like, you have to raise stuff at the lower level to preserve it on appeal. And that's that I think is probably one, but not the only one. There's a lot of appellate issues in this case, but that's a major one. The conviction rate in federal criminal trials is 99%. So you get used really quickly as a federal criminal defense lawyer to preserve your issues for appeal, because you have a much better chance of winning on appeal than you do the jury. But this was frustrating, because I thought we had a really good shot at this one. I thought everybody did a good job, and we just got killed.
There were some great moments in there when Torm made some arguments, and the judge came down and said, "You're just making this argument so that you can lay a record for appeal."
Yeah.
We're like, that's our jobs.
It's our fucking job, right? Like,
here's what's scary about the venue is, I mean, think about this for a lot of the audience. I know for a Law of Code is the DeFi crypto lawyers, the OG DeFi crypto lawyers out there. And it seems like the consensus in that group to deal with the US obstinacy on DeFi is geofence US, build outside the US, right? That's what most people do. If IRS gets around your geo-blocker, uses the right VPN, hits your DEX, you're an unlicensed money transmitter, they get you on the same count three and count four they used here, you're looking at 10 years. Every DeFi protocol in the world could be hit with the same thing and could look at not count one and count two necessarily, but even if criminals aren't using your DEX at all, they hit you with count three and count four, and you're looking at 10 years if this decision holds. That's scary stuff, man.
Scary shit. Yeah. It's universal jurisdiction, and it could be a prosecutor in Podunkville. And that can't be the constitutional basis for venue in the computer era. I think that's just totally, it's insane, right? And they're not theorizing it. One of the problems here is that there's no theoretical background for any of this stuff because it's brand new. Yeah. It's just, you're looking at a newly emergent body of law that hasn't existed before. And I think one of the properties of a body of law is that it has principles that are contradictory to other bodies of law, like contract law, tort law, have principles that just don't mix, right? Like, you can't use parole evidence in a contract case, but you can use it in a tort case. You don't get punitive damages in a contract case, so on and so forth. What you've got with computer law is you've got this newly emergent body of law that nobody's really theorized, that have principles that just don't work with other bodies of law. And I think part of that you're seeing play out here. But nobody, the prosecutors don't give a fuck about this. You've got a federal judiciary that's 80% former DOJ and basically a bunch of cops in robes, as a lot of people say. It's a recipe for disaster for a defendant. Like,
it was funny being in there. And when we started to gain some momentum, we'd see the prosecution. And it's almost felt when you're a kid and you go over to your friend's house and you break your friend's toy and they go to complain to their parent, "Oh, Michael broke my toy." That's what it felt like when we started to gain momentum in the courtroom. The prosecutors went to the judge, and the judge would reprimand us and hold in favor of the government repeatedly over and over again. It just felt like we were in the lion's den down there in D.C.
Well, even based on what you've shared so far, there seems to be quite a few irregularities with this case, just based on the standard operating procedure that you've experienced working as trial lawyers in the U.S. I want to talk about one thing, and you mentioned new areas of law, and blockchain obviously is very new and novel when it comes to the U.S. court system. And this idea of blockchain tracing being used as expert evidence is something that we didn't see 10 years ago. And now we're starting to see that in court cases. Could you describe what happened in this case, how it was used?
I'd love to, and I'll let Tor mainly do it. It's an area where I wanted to jump in the federal court, and they wouldn't let me, but we can get to that.
There's two, when we talk about blockchain tracing, there's two main components here that we're talking about that I think often got mixed up. One, there's just straight up blockchain tracing using like a blockchain explorer. You're just looking at the whatever mempool and you're just like looking at the straight up transactions. That's pretty straightforward. But even there, you've got people making speculative psychological leaps as to attribution, right? Because you still need to have some kind of outside evidence to make any kind of attribution. And there's that whole thing we were talking about where the flow of funds gets confused with the flow of control. And that, like, if I have one takeaway from this case going forward, is that is like the big thing to try to psychologically deal with the jury or anybody, because everyone's just, oh, I can trace it back there. There's a line. It must be that person. But the other type of blockchain tracing is not so much tracing as an attributive process. And this is clustering. And this is where you get these big multi-million-dollar unregulated companies like Chainalysis, which I think is functioning basically as a almost like a monopoly in this space. That's when they're taking addresses and they're making attributions like, oh, all these addresses belong to Bitcoin Fog. All of these addresses are associated with Silk Road. All of these addresses are associated with Argos. That is not information that you can just read off of the blockchain. And that's where it gets a little sketchy, because they're using heuristics, in this case, black box proprietary software and algorithms, that we weren't really allowed to look at. Like, we were given some stuff. They wanted us to sign like a 5-year non-compete to look at Chainalysis heuristics in a fucking federal criminal case. And we said no, right? And we said, can you name one federal criminal case in the history of the federal criminal courts, the entire history of the federal criminal courts, where a federal criminal defendant has been asked to sign a non-compete? And you know what? They couldn't name one, because there isn't one, right? We weren't allowed to see the source code, right? What Chainalysis was used for was to say, listen, here are all the flow of funds from the darknet markets like the Silk Road and all the shit like that going into Bitcoin Fog, right? And so that's where they get the component that Roman laundered $336 million or whatever the heck it is. It's like changing every moment. Interestingly, though, it came out on trial. They couldn't tell us the geographical flow of funds, in other words, where the funds were coming from, where they were coming from jurisdictionally, which, if you think about it, is really problematic, because what's illegal in one jurisdiction may be illegal in another. So if you're going to attribute and say, okay, that's $336 million worth of illicit funds, you need to show me that it was illicit where the transaction occurred. And they don't have that information.
And a lot of these darknet marketplaces, they sold things that were also legal. Sure, you could buy drugs or weapons on those marketplaces, but you could also buy books, you could buy clothes, you could buy computers, right? So for them to group all of those transactions that they're able to find from Silk Road, Alpha Bay, and say that they're all illegal and you're criminally liable for the maximum total, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
That shouldn't stand.
And so, JW, when you look to intervene then, what was the basis for rejecting that, and what were you looking to clarify?
It seemed to be one of those phenomena Tor was describing, where the government had a home field advantage. Here's one example that I thought would have been helpful to the jury. So I found an article in a DOJ Guide to Practice and Procedure, an internal law review the DOJ has, written by Chris Brown and Catherine Pelker. Right? The two prosecutors in this case. So the two prosecutors in this case wrote a law review article for the DOJ's own law review about crypto prosecutions. This is a manual for AUSAs around the country to read, help them do crypto prosecutions when they don't really know what's going on. So it tells you about fentanyl coming in and going to dead drops and all this stuff about that. There's this line in there that says, tracing's useful to generate leads. Don't use tracing alone to attribute ownership of illicit funds, which was exactly our theory of this case, right? Was exactly our argument, not theory of the case, but our argument. I had this paragraph that just shows, don't do what we are right now doing in this prosecution right now. And I wanted to put it up on a slide, and the judge says, oh, no, that wouldn't be fair to Ms. Pelker to put that on a slide. I don't know what to say to that. But that's the thing about tracing. Tracing's interesting to generate leads. Don't use tracing to attribute ownership. I think Tor and Mike did a great job of putting Chainalysis in a corner. And when they actually got on the stand, they said, oh, we don't attribute anything to Roman. We want to start by saying that. Which, why are you here if you're not attributing anything to Roman? It's blinding you with science here. Yeah. Chainalysis has a bunch of giant graphs.
Yeah, but it wasn't charts, science.
And they sophisticated our tracing is. It wasn't science. And the antidote to their entire thing, blinding you with pseudoscience. The antidote to everything they're saying is, what if on that first hop, the person in control of that Bitcoin address is not Roman? then everything you're showing us goes away. But there, but after 5 or 10 hours of showing the complicated charts and tracing is this science and we have a secret sauce, just trust us, the jury just goes along and says, huh, okay, but we have to keep repeating. All of this is irrelevant if that first hop is to an address not controlled by Roman, which is the kind of Occam's razor most likely solution. It's just frustrating what they're able to get away with.
And the government's own witnesses testified that was a possibility, right? And another key thing about this case is there's no eyewitnesses.
None.
Zero. The only one that was like Roman who testified, there's nobody saying, oh yeah, I know that Roman did that transaction. I saw him, I overheard him in a bar or whatever. This entire case turns on the tracing and them going through his notes and saying, oh, you know how to use Linux.
And tracing,
you know how to log in remotely.
From 10, 11 years ago.
And was that Mike? Yeah, from 11 years ago. And I want to add one thing that just jumped out when like JW was speaking. Okay. So you've got judges making these Daubert expert opinion determinations. One thing that the judge said about a year and a half, 2 years into the proceeding just blew my mind. Okay. And here's what it was. He asked, after he had jailed Roman based on the you know weight and credibility of the evidence about a year and a half ago, we're in the Daubert hearings. And the judge asked this question. Does the blockchain have an administrator? Now think about that. That's a great question to ask if you're an absolute beginner, right? Because then you're trying to figure out what is the blockchain? But almost 2 years into a federal criminal prosecution where the blockchain and blockchain tracing is central
and Bitcoin
to the prosecution. And yeah, that is a mind-blowing question. Yet that is the judge that wrote a decision saying that Chainalysis Reactor is reliable, even though there's no statistical error rate for it. You can't document its rate of false positives. You can't document its rate of false negatives, that there's no internal error rate analysis. That is the judge who wrote that opinion. And by the way, that is the only written Daubert opinion that we got. We had extensive Daubert hearings. The judge said this judge had a problem issuing written decisions for some reason. And we had all these expert hearings. We're supposed to get written decisions so we know what our experts can testify to. Of course, he's putting our experts through the ringers. He's like rubber stamping everything for the government. We never got any written decision. The only one we got was for Chainalysis Reactor the day before their witness testified at trial, when the judge and the court had months to do it. Months to do it, right? And then we get handed this fucking decision. That's all raw. Chainalysis Reactor, raw. This works. Yay. Go team, right? I've been doing this a decade. I'm used to judges being cops in robes, but that was one really just took the fucking cake for me. You know what I mean? And like nothing to help us in terms of who our experts, what they could testify to and what they couldn't. JW just ripped into him about what he couldn't testify to, but you're like having to go up there and wing it. And I'm not one, and again, I'm used to this in this space, right? But wow, this one really took the cake, right? You've got this little DC sort of cesspool kind of thing going on here, and you're all buddy buddies because the judge himself, former DOJ, deputy counsel for DOJ, right? Okay.
So here's the contrast. I went up to be an anti-money laundering expert. I'm a banking law professor, so I teach money laundering. I've done money laundering oversight when I was in Congress of FinCEN. FinCEN oversight was part of my jurisdiction. So I've got some, and I'm a forensic accountant trained in money laundering tracing, right? So that's me. Nope, judge says, no, I'm worried about, he said this, I'm worried about the jury seeing you're a law professor, banking law professor, and over-relying on you. So I'm not going to name you an expert in money laundering. By contrast, an FBI agent, a kid, a couple years out of college. Yeah. Yes, you're a money laundering expert. Yes, you are. Absolutely. And the sloppiness of the term money laundering, how it gets thrown around. I was awakened to this as I've grown as an expert. Historically, I'm just an academic banking law prof. So I think about money laundering a lot, but from the kind of right law review article side, did some policy work on it, got into forensic accounting and the methods used in tracing there. So I'm thinking when I get into this case, I start working on money laundering, and I've done a lot of civil forfeiture money laundering stuff in crypto recently. As I start getting into it, I think, oh, this is going to be some sophisticated money laundering analysis. Let me get my brain ready. Let me get my coffee in. They throw around that term so lazily and sloppily. Any transaction, and the FBI agent sits up there and says, that's consistent with money laundering. That's the magic phrase, consistent with money laundering, because it's a transfer. Every transfer then apparently is consistent with money laundering. You see this web of transactions and you think that's, they say that's consistent with money laundering. And you look at it and you think, you know, if you did a graph of my some of the wallets in my phone right now, where I play around with NFTs and I go back and forth between privacy protocols, it would look exactly like that. And most crypto users, it would look exactly like that. And I could see an FBI agent pointing to it and saying that's consistent with money laundering. Because what? Because it's complicated, because there's a lot of transfers there. And that's it. That's the level of analysis for determining something is money laundering that happened in this case. That's shoddy. That wouldn't survive in an academic world. It was eye-opening for me, the extent to which they could get away with throwing around that term in front of a jury.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear just all the factors that go into a case like this and how many things you guys will have at the appeal to really wield as well. One thing I want to talk about is this whole idea of money laundering in crypto. And we're starting to see this play out more and more in the courts. There's the Roman Storm case I mentioned. There's this Roman case, Sterlingoff. And a lot of it is based on this evidence from Chainalysis and from blockchain forensic software that can be used. But we're also starting to see this come up in cases like Binance as well, right? There's huge cases, there's individual cases, there's a whole plethora of cases that are happening here. Does this seem to you like a policy attack on the industry? Because I've spoken to a few other people in the space, and from a securities perspective, that seems to be the emphasis. It's that this looks a lot like a policy decision to bring cases like this.
I completely agree with you. It does look like an attack on privacy, on security, on cryptocurrency. One of the more disturbing things that we came across in this case was Chainalysis brought up the idea that while we have KYC, Know Your Customer, they're implementing and going to continue to implement KYT, Know Your Transaction. And it appears like they're lobbying federal agencies in the United States to adopt KYT in their regulations. It looks like the government wants to use Chainalysis wants to be the player that tracks and surveils the blockchain at a very high level and makes assumptions about every single transaction, right? You can take a look at the assumptions that happened in this case and the misidentifications that arose out of those assumptions. And now think about it, if that's applied to every single transaction in the crypto economy, this is only the beginning of this is going to snowball, and it's dangerous.
It's also, Jacob, I'm seeing it more and more, these lazy additions of a money laundering charge to criminal complaints and to civil asset forfeiture. It's convenient for the government because you get to freeze all their funds and then they can't hire a lawyer unless people are willing to work for free or for the possibility of something later, which congrats to you guys for doing that.
Yeah, I just want to talk about that for a second as well, because that was one of the next points I was going to bring up. So what happened when Roman was arrested with all his assets and all his Bitcoin, all his cash? Can you guys just talk quickly about that? Because I think it's an important point.
Yeah, really simple. They seized it, right? And then, so then he had a little bit of money that wasn't frozen, but that quickly ran out. And then we did something, which I'm never going to do again, called CJA, which is Criminal Justice Act funding, which is like what they pretend to be a legal defense fund for indigent defendants. It's a little bit, if you're in between the federal defender stage and being able to retain counsel, there's CJA. Total bureaucratic nightmare. They take forever to pay, and then they don't pay you for whatever weird reason, because you have to get it approved by the judge. We tried it for a little bit, and then we're like, no way, we're just not doing this. We had better luck. And by the way, thank you to the community, just fundraising through the community. What it was is the community got us through this case once they started hearing it, allowed us to go get the Airbnb and just do all this stuff. So we're really grateful to the community. But basically, you're screwed. And unless you got somebody like us like this, when we saw this, and we really looked at it and we saw he was innocent, and we like to do cutting edge computer cases, and this is the first of its kind. Unless you get somebody like us, you're fucked. And I'm getting calls from, as a matter of fact, I got a meeting down here in Miami from people who've got cases like this, and we try to talk to everybody to share, like, hey, if you've got a case, by the way, reach out to us like this. We will talk to you about our experiences in this case, because I think we need to build the resistance here And so we're happy to share. And that's why we're out like talking about this stuff. But it's tough because it's expensive. Like the government has a, DOJ has a $42 billion budget, right? And you're going up against this huge machine that's already biased against you with nothing. And it's hard.
Yeah. And if people just quickly, and then we'll jump back to you, JW, but if people do want to donate and assist in this fund, how can they do that? I'll put a link in the show notes below too.
Just go to our website, toreklund.com. Right on the front page, there's a button that says donate, and you can donate in all sorts of cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin and whatever. And even if you can't donate, just like talking about the issue and raising awareness and changing the background narrative, that's like really important too. Don't feel like, oh, I don't have money, I can't contribute. No, like just contributing to the conversation and the narrative is just as important as any money. Like anybody can do that, right? Like we all add it up together. We just become a big force, right? I'm a big believer in that. We're on the front lines of this, but I feel like what's changed now is we have an army behind us. And that's really empowering. Because now, like people, particularly after this verdict, people have come out and they're like, holy shit. You know what I mean? And we can change it. We've done it before on cases. I've seen it. It's a long haul and it takes a few years, unfortunately, for Roman.
This kind of inaccurate, unscientific blockchain surveillance that's happening right now in the world is implicating so many innocent actors. We've heard from corporations overseas getting implicated for things and flagged for things they didn't do, to individuals, how homes being raided by Interpol, the FBI, for alleged transactions that are clustered into illegal transactions. What happens is the government, law enforcement agencies around the world will rely on Chainalysis tracing. Go make an arrest, overthrow the person's house, tear apart their life, arrest them in front of their kids and family, and then quietly drop the charge. And that's it. It ruins people's lives and it's completely unnecessary and it's wrong.
Yeah. We heard from Mike about just the policy perspective there and where he thinks things were going, and JW was weighing in there, but I'd love to just turn that to you and just get your perspective on how you've seen, having been in this space for a number of years now, just the changing tone around the idea of blockchain and money transmission.
I think there is a strong policy from a faction in the government, because this is a politically driven policy, particularly by people in DOJ, SEC, Treasury, whose very bureaucracies depend on regulating these kinds of things. Bureaucracy is always seeking to feed itself, right? You got Gary Gensler over at SEC, who's like, Bitcoin is evil. It's not money. That's funny. I could buy goods and services with it. I've been doing it for a decade, right? I don't know why you're some kind of fucking Luddite with some kind of religious view of money. And there's this view at DOJ is that all Bitcoin is criminal, right? We can't have money that's unregulated that the government can't control because it's a threat to our control. So I think there's a very strong policy with a certain faction. And I think this is key because it's not a monolith. This is a political question, right? So, and once you've got a political question, that means you can change it, right? And so one thing I wanted to say to people is don't despair, fight it. We can change this. But I think there's this massive policy right now that all Bitcoin and crypto is illegal, even though that less than 1%, even according to Chainalysis, less than 1% of crypto transactions involve illicit funds. You got way more shit going on with fiat, because actually it's a lot harder to trace fiat than it is crypto, right? But one thing I've seen that's carried over from, like, I started with the Computer Fraud Abuse Act and hacker cases, and now I've gone over to Bitcoin because that's where it's happening right now. But like, the one thing that carries over is this sort of view that computers are magic and mysterious and somehow witchcraft. And anybody who's doing anything digitally somehow is some kind of evil wizard. It's very odd, but I think it's the layperson who doesn't, it's magical right now, right? We're like, Mike and I are in Miami. I don't even know where you are, Jacob, right? And the JW is in DC and we're, you know, talking, streaming electrons. That's magical. And people don't know how that works. And there's this fear of the unknown. And that superstition, that really primal thing, is oddly triggered by technology. And I think that's part of what's going on here with this conviction that's driving this mania. Besides the fact that I think you have another really big thing driving this, and that's money. That's profits. It's big business. Chainalysis is an $8.5 billion company. They hire prosecutors. They hired one of the prosecutors from this case. They're hiring people from DEA. Their lead expert came in and testified in this case as a former DEA agent, right? And they're just, there's so much money involved in this. And I'm a capitalist, but when it comes to justice, I think the profit motive distorts it because they don't have an incentive, a financial incentive to find innocent people or make sure somebody's innocent. Quite the opposite. Their financial incentive is to find people guilty because that's what's going to sell your product. And that's what I think is perverse and why I think it's even more perverse that the code for these kinds of forensic softwares aren't open source. And I think this is an entirely unregulated industry right now that's dominated by one player. And I think it needs to be regulated. I think these forensic softwares need to be open source. I think they need to be peer reviewed, right? And they shouldn't be able to hire people from DOJ. They should not be able to work with prosecutors who later know that when I leave DOJ, I can go get a seven-figure job with these guys. That's fucked up. That's happening with the CFTC. It's happening with the CFTC. Yeah, it happens in this case. It's like everyone's like, oh, no, this is okay. The judge at one point even said, because we raised this, we weren't allowed to put on this defense. The judge said at one point, oh, I don't think money's really affecting anybody in this case. And I'm like, I'm in Washington, D.C., and somebody just said money doesn't fucking affect the way people think. Oh, that's right. When you do it, all the normal things don't apply, right? Like, where the fuck am I? What drugs did I take in the 90s that are coming back now? Anyhow, that's my two cents on the policy.
Yeah. No, Tor, that's a really interesting perspective too, because we've seen a lot of people in the crypto space and in the non-crypto space, like Elizabeth Warren wrote that letter. That's an interesting perspective about people from government going into the crypto space that I don't think is spoken about very often.
Have you noticed that?
I think it's a huge problem with all the bureaucracies. What did you say, Mike? Sorry.
You can go on about that one. The two prosecutors who were on this case originally, one of them became a magistrate judge in D.C. who's writing opinions that are favorable towards Chainalysis. And the other prosecutor became the senior legal director of Chainalysis. So you can see where they're going. In fact, one of the lead investigators who was working for the IRS ended up on this case, big player on this case, ended up working for Binance. And he's one of the Binance individuals who is currently under arrest in Nigeria while they play their political thing out, which is a whole other thing. But I liked what Tor was saying about how people in computers, they get treated like witches. It almost feels like we're in 1692 Salem, Massachusetts. And it's that same kind of psychological hysteria and those same kind of psychological based feelings that are at play here as we're at play in Massachusetts. And that might be where Elizabeth Warren is getting it.
Yeah.
She's from Massachusetts, isn't bank she?
Yeah, she's a big banker. That's all she is. She just cares about the big banks, man. You know what I mean? My favorite corruption of justice by the profit motive in this case starts with this IRS investigator called Aaron Bice, who's one of the first investigators on this case. And he starts this company. I think he dusts off this LLC he had from college called Exigent LLC. And when Roman is arrested, and by the way, all the prosecutors, everybody, they're like talking to the press for years, Andy Greenberg's book, like all this shit like that. They're doing all this prep. This is the first case that we've had. Now, we've had cases written up in books, but this is the first case we've had where we could read about our case before it went to trial. Because in Andy Greenberg's book, they had like a conversation with Roman, with his arresting officers. We're like, what the fuck is this? You can look up all the prosecutors in the index, right? Why? Careerism, right? Of course, like ambition, the same thing that drives all of us. But the problem is when you put it in the justice context, it perverts things. Anyhow, Aaron Bice, my favorite thing, starts a company called Exigent LLC. Roman's arrested, right? They issue this press release thanking everybody, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's great. It's like the title crawl in a fucking movie. First company that is thanked is Aaron Bice's Exigent LLC. Now, we don't see anything in the discovery, or you don't hear anything in the entire trial about Exigent LLC. What happens 5 months after Roman is arrested? Chainalysis buys Exigent LLC. And Aaron Bice still works for the IRS as a fucking criminal investigator. Okay. How? No, but remember, money doesn't influence anybody in Washington, D.C. Money doesn't influence anybody when they're investigating a case, right? Because when we become prosecutors and when we become law enforcement agents, somehow we're no longer fucking human. I call it the noble prosecutor fallacy, right? What is going on there? I think that needs to be investigated. We weren't allowed to pursue that at trial. We weren't allowed to pursue the fact that the lead prosecutor, Catherine Alden Pelker, started as an FBI agent on this case and brings it, looks like she's the one who brings it to Washington, D.C. So we issued a subpoena for her to get her testimony. The judge quashed it. He's like, there's no way. You know what I mean? There's no way. My social group. Right, yeah. They would never. My friends would never. Yeah. My friends are perfect. They would never. You know, what the fuck, man? Like, where the fuck? Anyway.
Look, you guys see it from the side that I think a lot of prosecutors don't, where you're seeing someone who's spending a good portion of their life and who knows how long in prison based on things that you have good reason to believe aren't true. And that's, yeah, I can't even imagine what that feels like. I could sense the passion that you both have to this.
And Roman's like the nicest guy ever.
Yeah.
He's nice. He's smart. He's kind. He's empathetic. And he's been handling his situation with the utmost class and dignity. And I'm just really impressed at how he's been handling this. And I really want to get him out of there. This is a fucking
nightmare. Yeah. Well,
let's talk about that. Like, what's the past 3 years of his life been like? Can you guys share anything that you've seen and what he's been through?
He's been in shitty local jails. Like here's something else they did, right? So they arrest him, right? And you know, he's never set foot in Washington, D.C. He's put in a remote jail in Warsaw, Virginia, the Northern Neck Regional Jail. Total nightmare for us to get access to. Like at one point they lied and said we were trying to smuggle in fucking cigarettes, which is like ridiculous. And go to like jails for a decade. Like we just had very limited access to him. He had limited access to the discovery for his review. Then we finally got him moved to, where did we get him moved to? Alexandria, Mike? And then that didn't work out.
Where he was in the jail is one of the witnesses who was testifying against him, who happened to be Ilya Lichtenstein.
Yeah, they like just do everything they can to sandbag you. So he's like in really shitty conditions. It's a little bit better now, that strangely now that there's been a guilty verdict, right? But it's not great. He's been locked up for 3 years.
Even during the trial, though, there were days when he'd come to us and he'd say, oh, my cell was broken into. They stole my tablet and messed around with my papers and took all my food. He was getting like 2 hours a night of sleep because they keep the lights on and have the fans on. It is uncomfortable in there. It is not.
Buy an electric razor and nail clippers to bring to him and ask for permission from the court so he could shave before he appeared. You know what I mean? And there was like more than one hearing where we tried to get him. And the judge is like, oh, he's a flight risk. He's got 4 passports, all this shit like that, which is like ridiculous. But it was one of the hearings, or maybe it was the hearings to unrelease the funds, where one of the prosecutors said something that I'll never forget. And they said that Roman's got the burden to prove that he's innocent. Okay. Oh, that was unbelievable. Those of you who don't know the American system, supposedly you are innocent until proven guilty. And I heard a federal prosecutor say in federal criminal court in the District of Columbia that our client had the burden to prove he's innocent. Unfortunately, you know what? That's true. That's the reality of what you are facing. And this is why 90% of cases plea out, because you're looking at a 99% conviction rate. The problem that Roman had here with taking a plea is he'd have to fucking lie. Like they were like, give us the private keys. They're like, give us the private keys to Bitcoin Fog. He's like, I don't have the fucking private keys to Bitcoin Fog. You know what I mean? Like, how I can't, like, I don't have this shit, right? So, like, one of the most frustrating cases.
Just this morning.
Yeah, we're not done. We're halfway.
I thought that we had a chance to get him. The jury deliberated for, what was it, 3 or 4
two
days?
2.5 days.
And if you're familiar with the standards under which the jury is supposed to make their decision, if they have any reasonable doubt whatsoever, they can't go at the government. They're supposed to go at the defense. A lot of criminal cases that go to a jury trial, the jury goes in there and within an hour or two, 3 or 4 hours, maybe max, they come back with a guilty verdict. If the jury goes in there for multiple days and the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, then there must be some doubt there, right? I just think that if there's ever a jury that's in there for more than a few hours, it becomes difficult to recognize that there is reasonable doubt. If you think about a juror who's in there and what they're processing in their mind, they're thinking, did he do it or did he not do it? And to recognize that there's reasonable doubt is a much more malleable dynamic that requires a little bit of introspection to see about how you're thinking and how you're feeling and how you're discussing it, than to determine that, oh, he's guilty and he did it. That's a more concrete, definitive answer. And I think as humans, we're more attracted to that concrete, definitive answer than the wishy-washy, introspective understanding of what is reasonable doubt. I think that played in the jury's decision as well.
Even just the fact that it would take 2 days, right? When you think of, or 2.5 days, when you think of something beyond a reasonable doubt, it should be quite obvious. So anyways, that aside, I want to thank you guys for speaking with me. Really enjoyed this conversation. And I think anyone who's heard it, if you want to donate, if you want to get involved, if you want to share the word of what's going on here, Mike and Tor both have a bit of a road ahead, and Roman as well, of course, and JW too. Is there anything else that you guys want to mention that we haven't covered or just want to share?
Yeah, Roman's sentencing is July 15th. Reach out to us if you want to get involved. We will respond. If you don't hear from us, we're just busy, hit us up again. Like, we're not ignoring you. We just need all the help we can get. Talk about this case, raise awareness. This is as much a political issue as it is a justice issue. Do not despair on this front. If you despair, that's when you lose. You just got to keep fighting. And we're at the halfway point with this. And again, we'd just like to say thank you to everybody in the community who's been supporting us. We've gotten us this far. We're not giving up. We're going to keep on going. We're going to fight to the last fucking fight, last second of it, whatever. So thank you.